From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's political future is looking very uncertain. President Biden has joined a chorus of Democrats calling on him to resign, following a report released yesterday by New York State Attorney General Letitia James, the result of a five-month investigation into accusations by 11 women who said Governor Cuomo sexually harassed them. Cuomo defended himself yesterday.
I never touched anyone inappropriately or made inappropriate sexual advances. I am 63 years old. I've lived my entire adult life in public view. That is just not who I am. And that's not who I have ever been.
Here is one of Cuomo's accusers, former aide Charlotte Bennett on CBS.
He sexually harassed me. I am not confused. It is not confusing. I am living in reality, and it's sad to see that he's not.
We're joined now by New York State Senator Jessica Ramos. Senator Ramos, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you were among the lawmakers calling on Governor Cuomo to resign back in March when women began coming forward with allegations of sexual harassment against the governor, even before this investigation was completed. What is your reaction to this report?
Well, I've been feeling very disappointed and embarrassed for our state. You know, we have at the helm someone who has created a very toxic work environment and who actually also has been involved in a nursing home scandal where many New Yorkers lost their lives. I had called his resignation then as well. I think that he has long felt that he's beyond reproach and has continued to undermine the attorney general as she has concluded her investigation. It's the right time to do the right thing. It's time for him to resign.
Governor Cuomo has defended himself. He denies that his behavior was sexual harassment. And he showed this slideshow of pictures of himself embracing and kissing and touching people. He says he does this, quote, with everyone. What did you make of that slideshow and his denials?
You know, there's a conversation to be had about consent, of course. And I think that that slideshow actually triggered not only the victims of his misbehavior, but many women who have experienced sexual harassment in the workplace or anywhere else. It was pretty damning, the 168-page report. He's not simply being accused of hugging and kissing. We know that there is actually an investigation being conducted by the district attorney in Albany as well into one of the accusations. And so this is a very serious matter. And this is why I'm so happy that President Biden came out to ask for his resignation as well. Our Democratic Party and New York State cannot be complicit in this predatory behavior.
The Cuomo administration, as you mentioned, was under scrutiny for allegedly covering up the number of COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes during the pandemic. And there is this ongoing investigation by the New York Attorney General now into whether Cuomo misused state resources to write his book, American Crisis. So I wonder, do you think all of these issues combined and now with this months-long sexual harassment investigation, do you think it's all affected the governor's ability to actually do his job?
I think this is an unfortunate distraction away from the business that New Yorkers are expecting its government to do. You know, we haven't been able to give New Yorkers the rent relief that they need. We are seeing lots of homelessness on our streets. There are shootings happening across our state. These are the issues that we should be tackling right now. But unfortunately, we have to be able to take care of the governor and make sure that the appropriate course of action is taken here. You know, in the legislature, we're ready to impeach should he not resign. If the New York governor is impeached, then he will not be able to hold office during the impeachment trial. The lieutenant governor becomes governor. And so he needs to make a determination, a decision about whether he is going to undergo the impeachment process through both the Assembly and the Senate, or resign and allow us to save time and get back to work.
So to be very clear, you and your fellow lawmakers are ready to impeach Cuomo or remove him from office if he does not resign?
Well, in my house, Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins has long been calling for his resignation. And now, just yesterday, the Speaker of the Assembly, Carl Hastie, did come out to say that his house would be ready to start the impeachment process. And it's a lengthy process. It has to start in the Assembly. After the Assembly, it will have to wait 30 days before the Senate conducts its trial and we vote to remove him from office. This is all time-consuming, and we would very much like to avoid having to go through this if he resigns.
Do you think he will fight it to the end?
It's hard to say. I mean, the governor has long showed that he feels he's beyond reproach, that he believes that he's above the law, and has manipulated narratives left and right. But at the same time, I think that he has a great respect for his father's legacy and shouldn't want to drag the Cuomo name in this way. So my advice to him is to resign, and I hope that that's what he does.
Jessica Ramos is a New York State senator. Senator Ramos, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Every year, pharmacies fill billions of dollars of prescriptions that patients never use. Some of the most expensive drugs are cancer-fighting pills, oral chemotherapies that are tough to afford for a lot of people. That's why a group in Memphis set up a way of turning one patient's waste into another's lifeline. Katie Reardon from member station WKNO reports.
Mary Janine Bolchazi knew something was wrong in late 2019 while addressing her Christmas cards at home in California.
I couldn't really form the letters, and I was a Catholic school principal, so, you know, we were taught by nuns cursive writing.
Doctors diagnosed the 77-year-old with primary central nervous system lymphoma. After intravenous chemotherapy took a toll on her kidneys, her physician switched her to a chemotherapy pill. The drug was easier to manage, but the cost? Around $500 a pill, or $15,000 monthly.
And I said, oh, my God, Lord, have mercy on us.
Even with insurance, the out-of-pocket costs were still too much. So Bolchazi got in touch with Good Shepherd, a nonprofit pharmacy in Memphis.
So there's like three or four in that bag.
Founder Philip Baker is sifting through donations of oral chemo medications that could have been thrown in the trash, but instead have been sent here to Good Shepherd as part of its Remedy Chain program.
Meds that have been dispensed to patients, that they never opened, that are unexpired in the original packaging, literally in pristine condition.
Next, Baker inspects them.
And then we can redispense them to people who would not otherwise be able to afford their chemotherapy.
That's right. These meds are free, thanks to other patients' unused tablets and capsules. Good Shepherd gets its chemotherapy pills from individual donors and cancer clinics across the country.
A lot of times people pass away and they're on these meds and the family members are left with them.
Or often waste is the result of finding the right treatment. Rosemary, who we're only identifying by her first name to protect her medical privacy, had the dosage of her breast cancer medication changed twice. So she donated $27,000 of unopened meds, already paid for by insurance.
Medicine, as expensive as it is certainly something that should be recycled.
Meanwhile, the price of these so-called specialty drugs continues to rise. Stacy Doucette-Zina, an associate professor in health policy at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, says the average monthly cost of chemo pills is $14,000. Even with insurance, copays can sometimes be $2,000 or more.
About half of people who have that level of cost sharing just leave their pills behind.
Which can have dire consequences.
If you take them, you can live a normal lifespan. And if you don't, you can die from your cancer quickly.
A side worry is if they're successful and their treatment works and they overcome the illness, then they're going to be bankrupt because of medical bills.
That's Jeff Davis, who runs the Remedy Chain program, which is often a last resort for patients who can't get other forms of financial assistance. But there are some limits to what the organization can do. For one, reliance on donations means some medicines aren't always available. Then there's red tape, says founder Philip Baker.
What's worse is if you have a med for somebody, but you can't send it because their state law doesn't allow it.
At least 38 states authorize prescription drug recycling, but regulations vary. Nationwide, there's no lack of all kinds of medicine to be reclaimed. Kia Williams, founder of a California-based medication redistribution group called Serum, says the goal is to normalize drug donating.
How do we make it as easy for people to recycle this medicine as it would be for them to throw it away?
And then get it into the hands of people who need it. People like Mary Janine Bolchazi. Remedy Chain continues to fill her monthly prescription at no cost.
I can jump out of bed and say, hey, thank God for another day of living and loving, period. That pill keeps me alive.
For Here and Now, I'm Katie Reardon in Memphis.
This is Here and Now on a Wednesday, which means it's time to bring in our political strategists. We've got lots to cover today. President Biden and fellow Democrats are calling on one of their own to resign. And the CDC is extending a ban on evictions during the pandemic, apparently in defiance of the Supreme Court. Alice Stewart is our Republican today, and Bill Press is our Democrat. Hello to you both.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Peter. Great to be with you.
Good to have you. And President Biden said this about New York Governor Andrew Cuomo after an investigation found the governor had sexually harassed 11 women.
I think he should resign. I understand that the state legislature may decide to impeach.
You know, Bill, when the president of the United States says a member of his own party should resign, that's got to carry some clout. How much longer do you think Cuomo will dig in?
Well, I think Cuomo, it looks like Cuomo is going to try to trumpet out, if we can use that phrase.
What do you mean?
Meaning deny it and give phony excuses and hope that the clock runs and people will kind of forget about it. I mean, it worked for Donald Trump. He thinks it will work for him. It will not. His days are numbered. I hope it's clear. You know, we knew this report was going to be bad, Peter. This report is devastating. 11 women, well-documented abuses, clearly unacceptable, if not criminal behavior. Of course, that investigation is still ongoing. I think the speaker, the president, every member of the New York delegation, the Democratic Attorney General are all correct. He must resign. And if he doesn't, he will be impeached.
Alice, how are Republicans seeing this moment?
Well, they see it virtually the same as many Democrats are seeing it in terms of that was a damning report from the Attorney General, and it outlined extremely egregious behavior, harassment that they described as prolific and egregious. And when you have Democrats, President Biden, Nancy Pelosi, you have New York Democrats, you have members of the legislature in the House and the Senate, and even unions who have supported Governor Cuomo are all calling on him to resign. The writing is on the wall. And look, I think for these charges to come out as horrific as they are and detailed as they are, for him to claim that this is just his behavior and it's generational or cultural perspective, that he is just a touchy-feely kind of guy, that is insulting to the victims. It's insulting to anyone who realizes that not only has he destroyed the work life of many people in the office, he has lost the public trust and he is unfit for office, and he needs to go. If not voluntarily, the New York legislature needs to show him the door.
You know, you're right, Alice. Democrats clearly, just real quick, Bill, I'll let you weigh in in just a moment. Democrats clearly are lining up against Cuomo. And I'm going to invoke Bill here, who tweeted last night that he said, notice the difference. Democrats take sexual allegations seriously. Republicans ignore them. And Alice, I know this is a tough question, but I just wonder if he doesn't have a point. You know, Donald Trump didn't seem to have paid any political price in his party, even though he was accused of very serious sexual assault and rape. And I also didn't hear many Republicans call out Congressman Matt Gaetz this year when he was accused of having a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old.
Yeah, Peter, I'll say it now. I've said many times the former president's personal behavior with women is disgusting, it's egregious, and it's completely unacceptable. And I have always said that and have never defended that. Any kind of sexual harassment of this nature should not be tolerated. There is difference here in that this is in the workplace. This is there was a pattern of egregious behavior in the governor's office that also needs to be addressed. And that is one of the bigger issues here, is that this is in the workplace and it impacted the day-to-day work of the governor's office. And this is in addition to the other charges that are being investigated with regard to COVID and nursing home deaths, which is a completely different story. But I see while there are serious concerns about treatment of women, I see this also as much different than what we had with the former president.
Bill, I used your words, so I'm going to let you use your own now.
Well, Peter, if I may, look, Donald Trump was accused of serious sexual assault and rape, more serious than Governor Cuomo's even been charged with, and for twice as many women. I know Alice is not saying this, so I'm not attacking what she said, but there is no difference between Governor Cuomo and Donald Trump, except that Donald Trump did worse, and he got walked totally free. The party made him their leader. They elected him president. They fawned all over him for 4 years, and now they still want him to run for president again. I would just say, the difference is Democrats believe women and take sexual assault seriously. Unfortunately, the Republican Party, given Matt Gaetz and Donald Trump, does not.
Look, we could keep going.
Let me just say that's
very briefly, please. It's controversial.
Just quickly, I disagree with the fact Republicans don't take it seriously. But as I said, there's a big difference in egregious behavior in office and egregious behavior that happened prior to elected service.
Okay. Another big topic in the past week was, first of all, the expiration of the eviction moratorium on Saturday, and then President Biden's decision yesterday to extend that ban into early October. Bill, progressives in your party, they were outraged that the president had initially left it up to Congress to extend the eviction with the eviction ban with no time. Do you think that their anger was justified?
No. First of all, I think President Biden did the right thing. And above all, Cori Bush did the right thing. I mean, salute to her. She turned the world upside down single-handedly by having the courage and the wisdom to camp out on the steps of the Capitol to say we should be doing our job. Peter, the president for a long time had been telling Congress, hey, this eviction thing is going to run out. You better act. They didn't. I think it's shocking that they left Washington on Saturday without even dealing with this issue. And so the president said, okay, you didn't do it. I've been told I don't have the authority to do it, but damn it, I'm going to do it anyway. So good for him, but I think Congress should have acted. It's a public health crisis, not just a personal financial crisis.
Alice, what do you think? Should Republicans support an extension of the moratorium in Congress?
No, they shouldn't, because the eviction moratorium doesn't have the legal basis or the economic justification to continue. Look, Congress has already appropriated $47 billion of rental assistance to address this problem, and that money needs to get to where it's going, and it has not. So if Democrats were so concerned about these evictions, they would have put a lot more attention on getting the money that has already been approved into the pockets and coffers of those that need it. And we could have avoided this problem a long time ago.
Why do you say no legal
basis?
Even the Supreme Court, just real quick, the Supreme Court said that Congress could do this and that would be the way to do it.
Exactly. That's the point. Alice said it doesn't have the legal authority. That's Congress's job, to pass a law and making it a legal program. They should have done that. They ran away from Washington without doing it. Shame on them. But this is, again, as the CDC said, it's a public health crisis, not just the fact that these people are going to be in their families out on the streets. This is the right thing to do, and I would hope it would have bipartisan support to extend it for the right reasons.
There were two special elections in Ohio yesterday that I do want to note with both of you. First of all, in the 15th district, Mike Carey is projected to be the Republican primary winner. he was endorsed by Donald Trump. How much sway did the former president have here in this race, Alice?
I think a tremendous amount. Look, the Ohio's 15th district, very Republican, very red district, and Donald Trump is popular there. So it certainly made a candidate even stronger. So, you know, a lot of people say that Trump's endorsements may have seen their time, but you have to look at these as a district-by-district basis. And in that district, he certainly did help carry in that race.
Yeah, to your point, last week, a Trump-endorsed candidate lost a special election in Texas. Bill, over in the 11th district in Ohio, a moderate Democrat, Chantel Brown, she won in a crowded field that included Nina Turner, who was co-chair of Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential run. Was that another blow for progressives? You know, just a few weeks ago, they lost to a moderate in New York City's mayoral election.
You know, I find this somewhat amusing. First of all, it's a win for Democrats. It's going to be a new Democratic member of Congress from the very blue district, so that's not surprising. But, you know, I defy anybody to state a policy difference between Nina Turner and Chantel Brown. Chantel Brown is no conservative Democrat. They call her a moderate Democrat. There was no difference in policies. The difference was one of tone, and people felt the Congressional Black Caucus, Congressman James Clyburn, the most respected member probably of Congress, period, of either party, both felt that Chantel Brown could do a better job getting people together and getting things done in Congress, and so she won on that basis.
Well, Bill, it may be you may not be impressed by the distinction here, but if Donald Trump-backed candidates start winning every one of their elections, you'd be noticing that for sure, right? I mean, these matter. These distinctions, these tea leaves matter at this point.
I agree with Alice that coattails matter from district to district in different ways. Sometimes they count and sometimes they don't. It certainly worked for Mike Carey in Ohio 15. You know, President Biden did not endorse in this Ohio 11. Bernie Sanders supported Nina Turner, by the way, whom I worked with in 2016 in support of Bernie Sanders. She's a very good person. Yeah. And James Clyburn supported Chantel Brown, and the CBC did too, and she's the winner.
Let's leave it there. Bill Press, a Democrat. Alice Stewart, a Republican. Thanks to you both.
Thanks,
Peter.
Okay,
thanks, Peter.
Scientists are still studying whether a booster shot for the COVID-19 vaccine is necessary, but for now, the CDC says that it's not, and that isn't sitting well for some people who are watching the Delta variant rip through the United States. It turns out that people are getting extra doses on their own initiative. Rachel Kors has been writing about this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So people are going against advice. They're getting an unauthorized booster shot before the FDA has approved it. How common is this?
Well, as I talked to kind of pharmacists and other healthcare providers, they said the problem isn't terribly widespread yet. You know, we don't have, you know, mobs of people waiting in lines at vaccination sites like we did early on, but it's starting to catch the attention of, you know, health systems who, you know, have to make policies about this sort of thing, and insurers who are kind of grappling with how to pay for it.
Hmm. How's it even possible? I mean, don't you have to fill out a consent form that asks whether you've been vaccinated before? How are people doing this?
Yeah, so there are kind of two ways that, you know, we've heard so far that people are trying to, you know, get these additional shots. One of them is to go see their doctor. And, you know, different doctors will have different policies as to whether they would recommend an additional shot or not. Like, there's one example that I think just came out yesterday of a hospital in San Francisco that, you know, is open to giving additional shots after, you know, patients have spoken with their doctors. But there are other systems, you know, like the Mayo Clinic and the University of Washington that have made the opposite decision, and they're not allowing prescribing of extra doses at this time. Or they can choose to lie on, you know, consent forms and say it's their first dose, which kind of creates a headache for, you know, pharmacies and other providers that are administering these shots.
Is it even allowed? I mean, you said people are going to doctors to get permission to do this, but can doctors legally prescribe a third shot at this point?
It does appear to be legal. Whether it's advisable based on the evidence, I think, is an open question. And again, the CDC and, you know, FDA haven't recommended or authorized a third shot or a second shot for Johnson & Johnson yet, but it is happening in other countries, and doctors do have a little bit of leeway as to what they'll recommend for their patients.
Right. Countries like Israel and Germany are moving ahead with boosters for some more vulnerable people. But without that authorization in the United States, can we be sure that it's safe? Are people assuming some degree of risk here by taking that extra dose?
I think they are, you know, assuming some degree of risk. And when I asked CDC Director Rochelle Walensky about this, she said, you know, she acknowledged that some people are seeking additional doses. She didn't, you know, make an indication that anyone's going to be hunting them down necessarily, but she did ask that they, you know, report in kind of the vaccine safety system so they have some more data to work with. And there's also health equity issues because, you know, if some people have the time and energy to chase down these extra shots and other people don't, you know, that creates other ethical issues as well.
Earlier, you had mentioned that insurance companies are taking a look at this. How do they feel about people getting an extra booster?
They're being a little cautious right now because I think they very much don't want to be seen as, you know, not paying for vaccines. Anthem has said generally, you know, there won't be a copay. But then we've seen Aetna, who said, you know, if you get shots outside of these guidelines, then we're probably not going to pay for it. So I think they are kind of trying to each make their own decision in this kind of weird gray area time that, you know, may not last forever, but we're here right now.
Rachel Kors with STAT, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nearly 7 months after a pro-Trump mob stormed the U.S. Capitol, prosecutors are laying out their case against hundreds of individual rioters and also against far-right militia groups at large. The Justice Department has charged dozens of people with conspiracy, including members of at least three organizations that they say helped organize the push to stop Congress from certifying President Biden's election victory on January 6th. Micah Lowinger has been following this for WNYC's On the Media, and he joins us now. Hi, Micah.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. So last year, you listened in on and corresponded with some of these militia group members on an app they were using called Zello. We'll link our listeners to your investigations at herenow.org. But what are you learning, Micah, now from the prosecutions of some of these people that were at the Capitol on January 6th that lines up with what you were hearing in the weeks and months leading up to that event?
Well, in the months leading up to January 6th, we saw many instances in which far-right groups were recruiting around events in the news, such as lockdown protests, fears about Black Lives Matter protests, conspiracy theories about Antifa, and then eventually conspiracy theories about some plan to steal the election from Donald Trump, which we know never happened. And I was listening in on groups on Zello, this walkie-talkie app, and then eventually on January 6th, I listened in on a woman named Jessica Watkins, who's a member of a far-right group called the Oath Keepers, as she was actually breaking into the Capitol, speaking with people who are listening in from home. And right now, federal prosecutors are trying to make a case that members from some of these far-right groups, like the Oath Keepers, a militia called the Three Percenters, and then, of course, the street gang known as the Proud Boys, had actually planned to break into the Capitol, that it wasn't just a heat-of-the-moment manifestation of their anger about the direction of the election and the direction of the country, but actually a plan to stop the peaceful transfer of power and create some sort of diversion that would allow Trump to maintain power in some way.
Well, some of the tape that you recorded, Micah, from your investigation last year made its way into the congressional hearing about the January 6th event last week. Here's part of that video that the committee played at the start of the hearing, beginning with the voice of a woman you just mentioned, Jessica Watkins, a member of the group The Oath Keepers.
Hey, brother, we're boots on the ground here. We're moving on to Capitol now. I'll give you a boots on the ground update here in a few.
Multiple Capitol entries! Multiple Capitol entries!
Are you still in touch with some of these people?
Yes. I have maintained contact with some people in the militia movement who used Zello and were sort of swimming in similar waters to Jessica Watkins and other people who would break into the Capitol. By and large, most of these people have stopped responding to my messages, or they have been just kicked off the platform. After our reporting came out, Zello deleted something like 2,000 militia-related channels, like the one on which Jessica Watkins was speaking, which has probably played some role in destabilizing some of these far-right groups that relied on the Zello networks for recruitment and organizing. But of course, the other side of the coin is that when you deplatform groups, they become a little bit harder to find, at least in the short term.
Well, the scope of the investigations into the insurrection is really staggering. The Justice Department has charged hundreds of people and roughly 40 of them with conspiracy. You mentioned that this has had really a destabilizing effect on many of these groups, no?
That's right. So the three groups that have received the most scrutiny from the press, the public, and from law enforcement are the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and the Three Percenters. In one way or another, all three groups have been grappling with infighting, with questions about the competence of their leaders, and in many cases, some of these groups are splintering. Some are dissolving altogether. There was an organization called the 3% Originals. They just completely dissolved after January 6th. They said, it's become too hard to do what we do. The insurrection made us look really bad. And so, you know, we're throwing in the towel for now.
Do you know, Micah, how many people at the Capitol were part of a militia group versus people who were there for a rally and now are telling prosecutors that they just got swept up in the whole thing?
Yes, by one estimate, only 15% of people who've been arrested had an identified affiliation with an extremist group. So about 85%, the vast majority of people, were not members of an extremist group ahead of January 6th. On one hand, we could say, well, this points to an idea that researchers of the far right have been talking about for many years called the post-organizational paradigm, meaning perhaps we're entering into a period of far-right organizing where you don't actually have to be a member of a far-right group to participate in far-right violence. It also means that you don't have to be in a far-right group to consume conspiracy theories, disinformation, extremist material on the internet. And in many cases, we see people who showed up to January 6th who were concerned that the election was being stolen, but they weren't members of a militia. It is hard to know what exactly this means about the future of far-right violence in this country. It's certainly the case that with some of these groups in disarray, their potential to commit violence might sort of come down in the short term, and their national profile might be sort of quieter for a little while. But I am not convinced that their recent violence has all that much to do with just Trump. There's certainly evidence that far-right groups and the conspiracy theories and propaganda that they peddled in has been sort of swelling for many years at this point. They will continue to respond to the culture war and the political climate with or without a leader like Trump.
That's WNYC reporter Micah Loewinger. Micah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you're traveling through an airport this summer, you'll probably hear announcements over the PA system. Stay to the right on the moving sidewalk. If you see something, say something. Well, in Minneapolis-St. Paul, airport managers are trying something different. Instead of hiring professionals, they asked people already working in the terminal to sit down at the mic. Matt Sepik from Minnesota Public Radio reports.
Walk through the departure hall of the Twin Cities Airport, known as MSP, and you'll hear this from the overhead speakers.
May I have your attention, please? The President's executive order requires all individuals to wear an acceptable face covering while on MSP airport property.
The woman reading it sounds as if she could be a professional announcer or voice actor, but that's not her day job. In fact, Radhi Prince may be the person who scans your boarding pass. Prince, a gate agent at Delta Airlines, is among 10 employees from all over the airport making the recordings.
I saw the announcement for it. If you want to audition, give it a try. And I said, let's go for it. I wanted to just take a chance.
Airport customer service manager Phil Burke says about 65 workers auditioned.
We thought that maybe this would be a fun way to get our employees engaged in something maybe different than their day-to-day job.
The announcers include everyone from a TSA supervisor to a rental car office manager. Glenn Brown works at the United Airlines ticket counter.
All checked and carry-on baggage is subject to search.
While in his previous job as a wheelchair attendant, Brown spoke at an airport commission meeting about the need for a $15 minimum wage, a campaign that was ultimately successful. Someone praised his speaking style, and Brown remembered that compliment when it was time to audition. Now Brown and his colleagues hear his voice echo through the concourse every day.
I have a coworker right now who swears that I sound like Ice-T. And it's really funny. She was like, I knew I heard your voice, Glenn. It's Ice-T.
The announcements that the staffers recorded are heard throughout the airport. Emergency Communications Supervisor Candy Capra reminds you where you left your car.
Thank you for parking at Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. You are parked in the gold ramp at Terminal 1.
Capra's message has the added benefit of letting out-of-towners know that Minnesotans call parking garages ramps. Because of the strong interest from employees, airport managers say they'll make the PA announcer auditions an annual event. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
A U.S. district judge granted a temporary restraining order against the state of Texas and Governor Greg Abbott late yesterday. The Department of Justice has sued Abbott over his executive order to stop anyone who is not in law enforcement from transporting migrants in the state. Over the last few months, Abbott has directed state troopers and the National Guard to arrest thousands of migrants near the border, even though the federal government controls immigration policy, not states. So how did the governor amass this power, and is it legal? Paul Flav of Texas Public Radio reports.
The high rates of border crossings have allowed Texas Republican Governor Abbott to launch his own brand of immigration enforcement, and it sounds a lot like former President Donald Trump.
I will announce next week the plan for the state of Texas to begin building the border wall in the state of Texas.
Abbott has made clear he thinks the federal government was doing a better job under Trump, and so he stepped in. He sent 1,000 state troopers to the border in March, along with some Texas National Guard. It was called Operation Lone Star. According to the governor, they arrested 1,500 people, but referred 35,000 to Customs and Border Protection. He then said it wasn't enough.
But it's clear that this Operation Lone Star, as prolific as the results have been, it's clear that more is needed.
Using COVID-19 and increased border crossings as an explanation, Abbott issued a series of executive orders giving Texas the power to arrest, try, and jail border crossers in the state.
Governor Abbott has several times over the past couple months attempted to create his own version of immigration policy and to enforce his own version of immigration policy.
Kate Huddleston is with the ACLU of Texas.
But the Constitution does not allow him to do that. Immigration policy is up to the federal government.
Abbott went on the right-wing Ruthless podcast in June and said not only is he going to continue building the wall, he'll also arrest as many people as he can for state crimes like trespassing.
We will first be adding fencing right along the border, which will slow people to some extent, but also it sets up a crime. Anybody coming across the border who in any way tries to damage that fence, they are guilty of two crimes. One is trespassing, the other is vandalism.
If they catch people for state crimes, they will put them in state jails.
And so these people are subject to immediate jail time, that we will be putting these people in jail for a long time because of the crimes they've committed.
Abbott has threatened to close childcare facilities holding undocumented children for the feds. In recent weeks, he directed the National Guard to step up enforcement of state laws, and he told law enforcement to pull over anyone they reasonably suspected of transporting migrants from the border to other parts of the state. But is all this legal?
The Biden administration is suing Texas over the governor's executive order that restricts the ground transportation of migrants.
The Justice Department appeared in El Paso federal court to argue the matter, saying Abbott was obstructing the government's ability to execute immigration policy. Attorney General Garland called it, quote, dangerous and unlawful. Federal judges put a temporary block on Abbott's order. And Jeffrey Hoffman with the University of Houston's Immigration Clinic says the governor's other actions are likely crossing the line.
The state of Texas is using state jails to incarcerate immigration violators, arresting people, you know, immigrants under the theory of trespass. These are very, very problematic, and it invites a constitutional catastrophe.
Hoffman just published a piece for the Yale Journal of Regulation pointing to Arizona's attempts to write immigration into state laws in 2012.
Those were struck down. So, the issue there in Arizona was that immigration enforcement is exclusively a federal matter. It's not for the states to do.
Michael Greenberger at the University of Maryland says Texas using laws like trespass that are already on the books is different.
I think he would have an argument that he's protecting the sovereignty of the state's borders by having people who are not allowed to come into the state to stay out of the state.
But Greenberger says Abbott contradicts himself in interviews, saying he's enforcing federal law because the Biden administration can't. Many civil rights groups have raised alarms over the governor's latest executive order that allows state police to impound cars transporting undocumented immigrants if there is reasonable suspicion. Rudy Rosales is the Texas director of LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens. He says the order as written is so vague it invites racial profiling.
It's vague for a reason. It's meant to intimidate and to harass.
He says the governor's actions do nothing to help solve the humanitarian crisis at the border.
I don't have an answer for what's going on. I don't claim to, but I say the first thing we need to do is address the humanitarian issue of it all. Nobody wants people smuggling children. Nobody wants open borders. We want well-regulated humanitarian relief for those that come here seeking justice, seeking a better way of life.
Instead, he says the governor's actions are just sowing chaos and ratcheting up tensions at the border. The legality of Abbott's executive orders is likely to be determined by the courts. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flav.
Well, we want to hear from you on another story we're following. Are you feeling burned out from work? If you are, let us know. What kind of support would help? You can fill out a form at hereandnow.org or drop us a note at letters@hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jane Clayson in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. It's Here and Now.